millions of social media followers, saying of WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange said a 14-year-old could have hacked Podesta. Also said Russians did not give him the info. On October 26th, 2 days before Comey reopens the Clinton case, Giuliani tells Fox News' Martha McCallum that Trump has a surprise or two that you're going to hear about in the next 2 days. I'm talking about some pretty big surprise. On October 28th, Giuliani goes on the Lars Larson radio program and says that current agents in the FBI have been leaking information to him about the ongoing Clinton investigation, a Hatch Act violation, as federal employees are not permitted to participate in political campaigns or political activity in this way. On November 4th, Giuliani tells Fox and Friends that he heard about what Director Comey was going to do, reopen the FBI investigation into Hillary Clinton's private email server, before it happened. This has been boiling up in the FBI, he says. I did nothing to get it out. I had no role in it. Did I hear about it? Darn right I heard about it. When Giuliani's comments become a source of controversy, he insists that the pretty big October surprise he referenced in speaking to McCallum on October 26th was just a new Trump ad campaign. He will hedge somewhat in a subsequent interview with CNN, however, saying that Comey reopening the Clinton case came as a complete surprise to me, except to the extent that maybe it wasn't as much of a surprise to me because I had been hearing for quite some time that there was debate and anger within the FBI about the way they, active FBI agents, were being treated by the Justice Department. Wolf Blitzer, the CNN anchorman, extensively dissects Giuliani's Larson interview, however, noting that the former mayor said he was in contact with former agents and a few active agents who obviously don't want to identify themselves. In a later CNN interview, Giuliani will say he hasn't spoken to an active FBI agent in 8 to 10 months. Giuliani's insistence that I did nothing to get it out, and I had no role in it, with respect to the story that FBI agents were then, in Giuliani's words, in a state of revolution, is particularly telling, as indeed it is another man who will in the future be a legal advisor to Donald Trump who is responsible for that information getting to the media. That man, well-known Republican attorney Joseph DeGeneva, was, with Giuliani, one of the most vocal opponents of Comey's decision not to prosecute Clinton when Comey announced that final judgment in July 2016. DeGeneva's firm, comprising him and his wife Victoria Tunsing, now represents Sam Clovis and Mark Corallo, as well as, informally they say, Donald Trump. Calling FBI Director Comey a dirty cop, a liar, and worse than a criminal, DeGeneva says on the Laura Ingraham show on October 13, 2016, that his law firm will represent any FBI agent who comes forward and wants to testify before Congress about Comey's Clinton investigation. That an attorney who would say in April 2018 that he and his wife play the role of lawyers on television and in real life for Donald Trump would go on air less than 30 days before a general election offering to assist FBI agents in undermining Trump's opponent by way of testifying against the prosecutors who dropped her case underscores how close to Trump's orbit the effort to pressure Comey into reopening Clinton's case finally was. It appears DeGeneva did not stop there either. After Life Zet, founded by Laura Ingraham, reports on DeGeneva's offer, the Daily Caller, founded by fellow Fox News personality Tucker Carlson, reports just 96 hours later that a group of FBI agents looking to blow the whistle on Comey has indeed found an intermediary to assist them. Moreover, the agent's intermediary appeared to assist them within 24 hours of DeGeneva's offering to do just that. FBI agents say the Bureau is alarmed over Director James Comey urging the Justice Department not to prosecute Hillary Clinton over her mishandling of classified information, the Daily Caller writes. According to an interview transcript given to the Daily Caller, provided by an intermediary who spoke to two federal agents with the Bureau last Friday, agents are frustrated by Comey's leadership. The story, a Daily Caller exclusive, cites one person other than the FBI agents, Joe DeGeneva. The Daily Caller notes that more FBI agents will be talking about the problems at the Bureau. DeGeneva notes the agents will specifically point to the handling of the Clinton case by Comey when Congress comes back in session. The agents spoken to and aided by DeGeneva had repeated to the Daily Caller false claims about Clinton's emails, saying all the trained investigators in the New York field office of the FBI agree that there is a lot to prosecute Clinton for, but he, Comey, stood in the way. The idea that the Clinton email case didn't go to a grand jury is ridiculous. What the Daily Caller does not disclose at the time is that it is, according to the New York Observer, secretly being paid $150,000 or even higher by the Trump campaign in the form of advertising revenue, as the Trump campaign between September 2016 and Election Day is paying the Daily Caller for use of its email list. That DeGeneva has in fact been planning to bring pressure to bear on Comey through FBI leaks to the media is evident from an interview he gives to WMAL 105.9 FM in Washington, D.C., the same week he speaks to Laura Ingraham, in which he reveals that he's already been in touch with active FBI agents. "People in the FBI are starting to talk," he tells his WMAL interviewer. "They're calling their former friends outside the Bureau asking for help. We were asked today to provide legal representation to people inside the Bureau and agreed to do so. Comey thought this was going to go away. It's not. People inside the Bureau are furious. They think he's a crook. They think he's fundamentally dishonest. They have no confidence in him. The most important thing of all is that the agents have decided that they are going to talk." That after advising these agents, DeGeneva goes on to advise Trump, and is still doing so well into the summer of 2018, is confirmed by another Trump attorney, Rudy Giuliani, who tells Politico in June 2018, "Trump will call four or five people like Joe DeGeneva and say, 'What do you think? So-and-so says this. Who's right?'" It is unclear for how long Trump has been advised by DeGeneva, though the question is a critical one. For instance, in March 2017, DeGeneva will be a vocal proponent of the fake news that former President Obama had tapped Trump Tower during the presidential transition in order to unmask transition officials involved in sensitive conversations. It's a conspiracy theory lacking any evidence, and it will later be linked to an Israeli government-connected business intelligence firm, Black Cube, the chief competitor to Joel Zammel's Wikistrat, but it is nevertheless quickly adopted by Trump in the early weeks of his administration. That Trump shares informal legal counsel with the FBI agents who pressured Comey into reopening the Clinton case has not been widely discussed, but that the agents' illegal leaks to the media helped convince Comey to reopen the Clinton investigation, thereby costing Clinton the election, is clear. On October 30, 2016, just 2 days after Comey reopens the Clinton case, the New York Times reports that he did so because he believed that if word of the new Clinton emails leaked out, and it was sure to leak out, he concluded, he risked being accused of misleading Congress and the public ahead of an election. Further evidence of Comey's certainty his own agents were leaking to the media is found in late October emails he and his deputy Andrew McCabe exchanged, uncovered through a FOIA request by the conservative watchdog group Judicial Watch. In the Judicial Watch tranche of Comey-McCabe emails is an email from McCabe to Comey from October 25, 2016, alerting the latter to an article from the day before published on the website True Pundit, which reports that Democratic factions controlled by a Hillary Clinton insider paid almost $700,000 in campaign funds to Jill McCabe, Andrew McCabe's wife, who was a Virginia State Senate candidate in 2015. Andrew McCabe, True Pundit noted, was a senior FBI agent who advised Comey against criminally charging Clinton. McCabe believed the article had used an FBI leaker as a source, telling Comey it was a heavyweight FBI source. While Comey disagreed that the leaker was a heavyweight in the FBI, he agreed it was someone within the Bureau leaking details of an internal investigation. 48 hours later, he and McCabe meet in person, and he decides to reopen the Clinton case, partly, per the New York Times, because of his fear of continued FBI leaks. The same leaks Trump surrogate Rudy Giuliani had been discussing publicly on Fox News, and Trump supporter and future legal counsel Joe DeGeneva had personally facilitated. Indeed, the June 2018 Inspector General's report on Comey's decision to reopen the Clinton case will repeatedly cite Comey's concern about internal leaks as influencing his decision-making. Both leaks of information concerning Attorney General Loretta Lynch and leaks of information concerning the new Clinton emails. As the Inspector General, IG, will conclude, several FBI officials told us that the concern about leaks played a role in the decision to reopen the Clinton case. The IG will note also that the harm caused by leaks, fear of potential leaks, and a culture of unauthorized media contacts influenced FBI officials who were advising Comey on consequential investigative decisions in October 2016. The IG will quote one of the prosecutors in the Clinton case as indicating to him that leaks undermine investigations and that unfair leaks were an added consideration in the Clinton investigation. Per the IG, Laufman, a second prosecutor, told us that the Clinton prosecution team's goal was to be mindful that leaks could be used by political actors in furtherance of political agendas. The IG will find that Comey's concern touched equally on credible leaks and leaks of non-credible information, the latter sort of leak being the kind facilitated by DeGeneva. Comey's pre-election review of the new Clinton emails on former Congressman Anthony Weiner's computer will find no incriminating information, contrary to what DeGeneva's clients in the FBI told the Daily Caller to expect. When Comey reopens the Clinton case, the Republican National Committee will immediately declare that this shows how serious this discovery of new Clinton emails must be. However, in August 2018, it will be revealed that the true pundit story that concerned Comey and McCabe was written by a former employee of Republican National Committee Finance Chair Steve Wynn, who was appointed to his position by Trump in 2017. As it happens, DeGeneva is also a former employee of the Republican Party, having been, before entering private practice, chief counsel and staff director of the Senate Rules Committee and counsel to the Senate Judiciary, Governmental Affairs, and Select Intelligence Committees. The effect of the leaks facilitated by Trump surrogates and supporters and aided by former employees of the Republican Party and their associates is not just the reopening of the Clinton case, but the mass dissemination of the fake news that Clinton's new emails contain incriminating evidence, including supposedly proof that, as alleged by Eric Prince, Hillary went to this sex island with convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein at least 6 times. The convergence of Comey's decision and the supposed content of Clinton's new emails produces a vivid display of the influence and danger of viral alt-right conspiracy theories fueled in part by Russian disinformation and fake social media accounts. This display starts online a day after the Comey announcement and 10 days before the November election. It ends in a pizza restaurant in Washington. Indeed, the strangest Trump-Russia connection of October 2016 involves the Pizzagate conspiracy theory, which first appears in a Facebook post on October 29th. That post comes just a day after FBI Director Comey reopens the Clinton email investigation and a day after then-Trump surrogate Rudy Giuliani finishes a 3-day spree of radio and television interviews teasing an October surprise that will harm Clinton's campaign. Calling it a fake news scandal, Rolling Stone will describe Pizzagate more particularly as the surprisingly widespread belief that Hillary Clinton was sexually abusing children in satanic rituals in the basement of a Washington, D.C. pizza restaurant. The magazine notes that this conspiracy theory, for which no evidence ever emerges, indeed, not even a basement in the suspect pizza parlor, is born and disseminated during the presidential campaign through the work of, among others, Russian operatives and Trump campaigners. The claim that Hillary Clinton was a pedophile started in a Facebook post, spread to Twitter, and then went viral with the help of far-right platforms like Breitbart and InfoWars, Rolling Stone writes, name-checking a media outlet run by Steve Bannon and a podcast, radio show, and YouTube program frequented and sometimes even anchored by Trump advisor Roger Stone. After nearly a year of investigative reporting, Rolling Stone concludes that, along with average Americans and social media bots, foreign agents and domestic political operatives, many of them associates of the Trump campaign and others tied with Russia, are the progenitors of the Pizzagate fake news operation. The Facebook post that launches the conspiracy theory will be traced to a Cynthia Campbell in Joplin, Missouri, a woman, Rolling Stone speculates, with supporting evidence including a significant overlap in social media accounts, is the Carmen Katz who posted the October 29th allegations regarding the computer owned by former Congressman Wiener that was seized by the NYPD in late September 2016. Because Wiener's then-wife, Huma Abedin, was a top Clinton staffer, when the NYPD found Clinton emails on Wiener's laptop, there was speculation that the emails might contain new information relevant to the FBI's investigation of Clinton's private email server. The NYPD subsequently turned the laptop over to the FBI, which had possession of it by October 3rd at the latest. Though the Clinton investigation had been closed by the FBI in July 2016, Katz insisted that my NYPD source said it's, the contents of Wiener's laptop, much more vile and serious than classified material on Wiener's device. The email detailed the trips made by Wiener, Bill, and Hillary on their pedophile billionaire friend's plane, the Lolita Express. Yup, Hillary has a well-documented predilection for underage girls. We're talking an international child enslavement and sex ring. Because the FBI had possession of Wiener's laptop, but had not yet conducted any significant analysis of its content, the fake news that top officials at the FBI, particularly Comey and his deputy McCabe, were deliberately hiding incriminating Clinton emails, quickly spread across the internet. The claim dovetailed with long-standing claims by Russian agents, dating back to Joseph Mifsud's conversations with Trump advisor George Papadopoulos in April 2016, that there were Clinton emails still waiting to be released. In June 2016, the Russians were intimating to Donald Trump Jr. that the Clinton materials in Russia's possession were incriminating. The Pizzagate conspiracy thus seemed to coincide with a long-running narrative with which the Trump campaign had been enamored by October 2016 for 6 months. The investigation conducted by Rolling Stone ultimately sets the birth of Pizzagate much earlier than October 2016, however, and much closer to Russia, too. According to the magazine's November 2017 exposé, a possible seed of Pizzagate appears on July 2nd, 2016, when someone calling himself FBI Anon, who claimed to be a high-level analyst and strategist for the Bureau, hosted an Ask Me Anything AMA forum on the internet website 4chan. He claimed to be leaking government secrets out of a love for country, but it wasn't always clear which country he meant. At various times he wrote, Russia is more a paragon of freedom and nationalism than any other country, and we, America, are the aggressors against Russia. FBI Anon seemed particularly interested in the Clinton Foundation, as the Russians who had visited Trump Tower a month earlier also had been. Dig deep, wrote FBI Anon. Bill and Hillary love foreign donors so much. They get paid in children as well as money. A 4chan reader following the AMA asked FBI Anon if Hillary had sex with kidnapped girls. "Yes," replied FBI Anon. In October, writes Rolling Stone, the claim that FBI brass might be engaged in a cover-up of the content of the new Clinton emails on Weiner's laptop shows up on a discussion board geared toward NYPD officers called The Rant, then quickly makes its way to a Facebook group focused on law enforcement, then, in short order, ends up on Twitter thanks to an account, Eagle Wings, or at NIVISA4031, whose followers include Trump advisors Michael Flynn and Sebastian Gorka. According to Samuel Woolley, the research director of the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, California, the tweeting pattern established by Eagle Wings over many months confirms that, without a shadow of a doubt, Eagle Wings is a highly automated account and part of a bot network, which, as Rolling Stone explains, is a centrally controlled group of social media accounts. Another high-traffic Twitter account that immediately backs up Katz's claims, writing, "I have been hearing the same thing from my NYPD buddies too," also looks to be highly automated, per Woolley. According to Rolling Stone, Pizzagate was shared roughly 1.4 million times by more than a quarter of a million accounts in its first 5 weeks of life, and more than 3,000 accounts in our sample set tweeted about Pizzagate 5 times or more. Among these were dozens of users who tweet so frequently, up to 900 times a day, that experts believe they were likely highly automated. Even more striking, 22% of the tweets in our sample were later deleted by the user. This could be a sign, Woolley says, of someone sweeping away everything so that we can't follow the trail. The magazine cross-referenced a list of the 139 most Pizzagate-focused Twitter accounts. It found 14 that were linked to Russia, including one, at Pamela_Moore13, that had been retweeted by both Donald Trump Jr. and Roger Stone. Noteworthy here is that according to the New York Times, Donald Trump Jr. had in August 2016 been offered by Wikistrat's Joel Zammel at a meeting set up and attended by Trump National Security Advisor Eric Prince a multi-million dollar social media manipulation effort to help elect Mr. Trump. According to the Times, Trump Jr. did not appear bothered by the idea of election cooperation with foreigners, despite the fact that such cooperation would be a federal crime. The Times adds, it is unclear whether such a proposal was executed. The possibility of both Russian and Trump campaign involvement in a conspiracy theory that spread quickly across the internet in the 10 days before the 2016 presidential election, constituting an October surprise of the sort Giuliani had hinted at days earlier, is underscored by what Rolling Stone finds when it looks for intersections between the Trump campaign and the pre-election fake news operation. The Trump campaign's engagement with Pizzagate went far deeper, writes the magazine. We found at least 66 Trump campaign figures who followed one or more of the most prolific Pizzagate tweeters. Michael Caputo, a Trump advisor who tweeted frequently about Clinton's emails, followed 146 of these accounts. Corey Stewart, Trump's campaign chair in Virginia, who lost a tight primary race for governor in June, followed 115. Paula White Kane, Trump's spiritual advisor, followed 71. Pastor Daryl Scott, a prominent member of Trump's National Diversity Coalition, followed 33. Flynn's son, Michael Flynn Jr., followed 58 of these accounts. Some of the most popular Pizzagate accounts are ultimately traced to a Macedonian fake news farm run by a Macedonian media attorney, Trice Arsov. In July 2018, BuzzFeed will reveal that two American conservatives worked closely with Arsov and that at least two writers for the American fake news website Gateway Pundit wrote for the Macedonian attorney's fake news operation. Moreover, at least one member of Russia's Internet Research Agency visited Macedonia shortly before Arsov's first American politics website was registered. Ossoff meets the two American conservatives, with whom, according to BuzzFeed, he engaged in extensive cooperation via Facebook in 2016. One of the men, Paris Wade, at first denies even knowing Ossoff until he is confronted by the BuzzFeed reporter with his messages to the Macedonian. Wade's partner, Ben Goldman, will later admit the connection as well. Wade is found to have written 40 articles for the Macedonian's American Politics website. His brother Alex, 670. Another American, Alicia Powell, who now writes for Gateway Pundit, is given a job by Ossoff and allowed to write as many articles as I wanted for his sites. A second Gateway Pundit author, Oliver Dollimore, also writes news for Ossoff. According to the Las Vegas Review-Journal, Paris now boasts about getting Donald Trump elected. The Washington Post notes in November 2016 that shortly after the election, the group website Prop or Not, a nonpartisan collection of researchers with foreign policy, military, and technology backgrounds, issued a list of the 200 websites in the world that echoed Russian propaganda and were doing so during the 2016 campaign. Paris Wade's website, Liberty Writers News, made the list. According to the Post, the Prop or Not researchers used internet analytics tools to trace the origins of particular tweets and mapped the connections among social media accounts that consistently delivered synchronized messages. As for the member of Russia's internet research agency who visited Macedonia just before Ossoff got his first American politics site off the ground, an operation that former FBI agent Clint Watts told BuzzFeed would have required some startup capital, her name is Anna Bogachova, and special counsel Robert Mueller will indict her in February 2018 along with 12 of her IRA compatriots. Bogachova traveled to Macedonia right as Trump was announcing his presidential campaign in mid-2015, and during the same trip, she appears to have also visited Greece and possibly Italy, two of the three nations, the other being the United Kingdom, in which Trump National Security Advisor George Papadopoulos will have face-to-face contact with Russian agents or allies, at least one of whom is peddling what turn out to be fake Clinton emails. In an interview with Rolling Stone, one of the Macedonians who disseminated fake news into the U.S. market during the presidential campaign said that he often just amped up existing articles from right-wing websites instead of concocting his own news stories. Breitbart was best for this, he told the magazine, naming the website run for years by Steve Bannon, the CEO of Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. The Macedonians are right to be reading Breitbart and other pro-Trump websites in the days leading up to Election Day. When self-described private investigator Douglas Hagman goes on Alex Jones's InfoWars program 4 days after the Carmen Katz Facebook post to say, based on my source, Hillary did in fact participate on some of the junkets on the Lolita Express, the Pizzagate story is transformed from an obscure conspiracy theory to a mainstream phenomenon. According to Rolling Stone, Google Trends measures interest in topics among the 1.17 billion users of its search engine on a 0 to 100 scale. On October 29th, the day Katz posted the story on Facebook, searches for Hillary and pedophile ranked zero. But when Hagman broke the story on InfoWars, they scored 100. During his November 2nd appearance on Jones's program, Hagman implies, citing an NYPD source, that Clinton may have committed treason by allowing Huma Abedin to transfer classified intelligence to her relations or associates, Hagman's intimation being Muslim terrorists, adding that many of the higher-ranked NYPD investigators have been pushing for the FBI to reveal this information about Clinton and her emails. Whether he is one of the higher-ranking NYPD investigators Hagman is referring to or not, NYPD Deputy Chief Michael Osgood, the man in charge of the Wiener investigation for the NYPD in October 2016, will be found in April 2018 to have donated thousands of dollars to Trump's 2016 presidential campaign in the final 6 weeks before Election Day. Hagman tells Jones that there is a group that has banded together at the NYPD and FBI that's decided that we're not going to allow this, the new Clinton emails, to be pushed under the carpet. He alleges that a group of FBI agents in the Bureau's New York field office has secretly refused to destroy the hardware and data incriminating Clinton that it has been ordered to destroy. Most important, Hagman says to Jones of Trump surrogate Rudy Giuliani, that people better be looking at him really close and listening to what he's saying, because he's responsible, I would say, for a lot of this information coming from the NYPD segment of this group of NYPD and FBI patriots that we see forming. The same day as the Hagman-Jones interview, Michael D. Moore, a former employee of Trump's eventual RNC finance chair Steve Wynn, publishes the sum and substance of the Pizzagate conspiracy on True Pundit in an article entitled Breaking Bombshell, NYPD Blows Whistle on New Hillary Emails, Money Laundering, Sex Crimes with Children, Child Exploitation, Pay-to-Play, Perjury. The article is retweeted almost immediately by Trump's shadow national security advisor and future national security advisor, Michael Flynn, who thereafter deletes his retweet for unknown reasons. Flynn's deletion will effectuate the deletion of a Trump Jr. tweet, as Trump Jr. had retweeted Flynn's original link to True Pundit. 2 days later, another of Trump's shadow national security advisors, Eric Prince, recounts on Steve Bannon's Breitbart radio station a conspiracy theory similar in its contours to Pizzagate. See Chapter 9. Clinton's emails, Prince says, contained a lot of other really damning criminal information, including money laundering, including the fact that Hillary went to this sex island with convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Bill Clinton went there more than 20 times. Hillary Clinton went there at least 6 times. This piece of fake news will also be retweeted by Michael Flynn, but this time without any subsequent deletion. On November 8, 2016, Trump invites Prince, whose importance to his campaign will never be acknowledged, either in 2016 or at any time afterward, to his election night party, and he will name Prince's sister, Betsy DeVos, his Secretary of Education. When Prince testifies before Congress in November 2017, he will present himself as having had no formal or even informal role in Trump's 2016 campaign. Annotated History. Trump fired Stone in August 2015, or to hear Stone tell it, Stone quit at that point, but the correspondence between the two men hasn't abated as of October 2016, a fact that will eventually lead Special Counsel Mueller to assert in his July 2018 indictment of 12 Russians that Stone stayed much more involved in the pro-Trump movement after his departure than his exit from the Trump campaign proper might have suggested. As of August 2018, the likelihood of Roger Stone's being indicted by Special Counsel Mueller appears high. Stone protege and former Trump advisor Sam Nunberg said on MSNBC, following his appearance before Mueller's grand jury and basing his opinion on the questions Mueller's prosecutors asked of him, "I expect Roger Stone to be indicted." Shortly afterward, another one of Stone's aides, Andrew Miller, repeatedly refused to honor a grand jury subpoena from Mueller, moved to quash, invalidate it, after 2 months of ignoring it, and finally was found in contempt of court for defying it. All, Stone said when asked about Miller, because Miller had refused to bear false witness against me. Stone's friend Michael Caputo likened his appearance before the grand jury to a proctology appointment with a very large-handed doctor. And on August 27, 2018, Stone himself predicted that he would be the next person indicted in the Mueller probe. "Mueller may frame me for some bogus charge in order to silence me or induce me to testify against the president," Stone told The Guardian. The intermediary Stone references is now believed to be former comedian and current radio host Randy Credico, who will be subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury by Special Counsel Mueller on August 10, 2018. Mueller's interest in Credico appears to focus on threatening emails Stone allegedly sent him in spring 2018. According to Mother Jones, to which Credico forwarded a number of emails he said were from Stone, an email Stone wrote to Credico on April 9, 2018 said, "I am so ready. Let's get it on. Prepare to die, cocksucker." According to the magazine, Stone was responding to a message from Credico that indicated Credico would release information contradicting Stone's claims about the 2016 election and that all will come out. Stone defended his "prepare to die" email as a response to news that Credico had terminal prostate cancer. Stone added that most, if not all, other messages Credico might show Mother Jones would probably be fabricated. For his part, Credico said that he does not have prostate cancer and did not act as an intermediary between Stone and Julian Assange as Stone claims, implying that Stone's contact with Assange was direct, just as the former Nixon aide and longtime Trump and Manafort associate had originally claimed. According to Mother Jones, Credico also claims that around the time Stone was interviewed by the House Intelligence Committee in September 2017, Stone told him to just go along with his story. Nevertheless, in May 2018, Credico represented to four Democratic House Intelligence Committee staffers that he was in contact with Assange through a WikiLeaks associate, and that he wanted to pass a message from Assange to Congressman Adam Schiff, the ranking member of the committee, to the effect that Assange wanted to meet with Schiff face-to-face. In August 2018, Mother Jones reported that Assange had called in to Credico's radio program. It noted, too, that Stone's lawyer had told a congressional committee that Mr. Stone concedes that describing Credico as a go-between or intermediary is a bit of salesmanship. The truth of the Stone-Credico-Assange relationship is still unknown. Shortly after the Manafort and Cohen convictions, Trump will tweet angrily about flippers, witnesses who commit crimes, then cooperate with prosecutors in later cases against their co-conspirators, referring to them as individuals for whom everything's wonderful, and then they get 10 years in jail, and they flip on whoever the next highest one is, or as high as you can go. Trump unfavorably compares flippers to his brave former campaign manager and chairman Manafort, who, unlike Cohen, refused to break. In August 2018, the New York Daily News reported that Trump was so eager to pardon Manafort, even before Manafort's upcoming trial in D.C., that he was considering firing White House counsel Don McGahn because McGahn was trying to dissuade him from the pardon. Multiple aides told Politico they expected Trump would ultimately pardon Manafort, and a Vanity Fair article released the same week said that Trump's reaction to the convictions of Manafort and Cohen was to spend the weekend calling people and screaming. Vanity Fair noted that an additional contributing factor to Trump's ire was the news, hard on the heels of the Cohen and Manafort guilty findings, that the longtime chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, Alan Weisselberg, and one of Trump's friends at the National Enquirer, Enquirer publisher David Pecker, had both been granted immunity by Special Counsel Mueller in order to secure their assistance in his investigation. The Los Angeles Times thereafter noted that Pecker allegedly has a vault full of documents and other materials that could damage Trump, even incriminate him if they are disclosed to the special counsel. Chapter 11. The Transition. November 2016 to January 2017. Summary. While not yet in power, Trump, his family, and his aides begin acting as though they are as soon as Trump wins the 2016 presidential election. Beginning less than 2 days after the final returns come in, several Trump aides and family members working on the transition team will call, meet, and negotiate with Russians and other foreign nationals. The last of these actions may well violate the federal Logan Act, which prohibits private citizens from negotiating U.S. foreign policy with foreign governments. Most of those in Trump's orbit who surreptitiously meet with Russian or other foreign nationals will thereafter fail to disclose or else lie about their actions. Meanwhile, a cadre of aides, associates, and family members, including Jared Kushner, Eric Prince, Michael Flynn, Tom Barrack, Rick Gates, and Bud McFarlane, are playing a dangerous political game. The game involves seven nations, the United States, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Syria, Iran, and Russia, and seven seemingly unrelated subjects: Kushner's worsening money troubles, Saudi-Qatari tensions, the Saudis' desire for nuclear power, and eventually the right to build a nuclear weapon, the Emiratis' own nuclear ambitions, Saudi and Emirati hostility toward Iran, and particularly Iranian involvement in the war in Syria, Russian construction firms' opposition to U.S. sanctions, which are hindering them from making tens of billions of dollars building new nuclear reactors in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and Russian actions relative to the war in Syria, which are ostensibly being coordinated with Russia's ally, Iran. These issues engage parties that don't at first appear connected to one another, but at least part of their correlation involves the United States dropping sanctions against the Kremlin in exchange for the promise of a big financial windfall for Trump and his relatives. In the midst of these transition team attempts to illegally negotiate with Russian nationals and other foreign actors, two complicating events occur. The American intelligence community releases a report confirming there was a coordinated Russian campaign to interfere in the 2016 presidential election on Trump's behalf, and BuzzFeed, on January 10, 2017, publishes a 35-page dossier of raw intelligence claiming that Donald Trump has been compromised by the Kremlin since at least 2013. The facts. Less than 48 hours after the election, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov confirms that there were many undisclosed contacts between the Trump campaign and Kremlin agents during the 2016 presidential campaign, exactly the sort of clandestine communications European intelligence agencies had warned the CIA of in the summer of 2016. According to an interview with Ryabkov by Russian news agency Interfax, the same outlet George Papadopoulos granted an interview to with campaign permission in September 2016, there were contacts. "We are doing this and have been doing this during the election campaign. Obviously, we know most of the people from his, Trump's, entourage. I cannot say that all of them, but quite a few have been staying in touch with Russian representatives." The response to Ryabkov's comments from the Trump campaign is immediate and categorical. The Trump campaign had no contact with Russian officials before Election Day, Trump's personal assistant Hope Hicks says. Hicks will later tell congressional investigators that she sometimes told white lies for Trump during the presidential campaign, adding that none of these white lies involved Russia. As American media report on Ryabkov's and Hicks's comments, Putin's right-hand man, Dmitry Peskov, announces that he will be coming to the United States in under 96 hours to attend a chess tournament a few blocks from Trump Tower. In the immediate aftermath of the election, President Obama issues two critical warnings. The first he offers in a face-to-face conversation with Facebook creator Mark Zuckerberg, who 72 hours after the election says that there is no possibility that material posted on Facebook in 2016 had any impact on the presidential election and that any suggestion otherwise is crazy. Obama urges him to take the problem of fake news and propaganda seriously, which Zuckerberg ultimately does when he admits in July 2018 that instead of the no election impact he spoke of in November 2016, he now recognizes that material posted on Facebook during the campaign, including Russian fake news and propaganda, was in fact influential. The second warning, sent via emails from the Obama administration to Trump transition team members, unambiguously tells them not to send conflicting signals on U.S. foreign policy to foreign officials before the inauguration, and to include Obama State Department personnel when contacting them. A former Trump administration official will tell the New York Times in December 2017 that the incoming administration explicitly agreed to honor President Obama's pointed request. Nevertheless, within 48 hours of Trump's November 8, 2016 election, Michael Flynn, who has no official role in the transition and has been denied a White House position by transition head Chris Christie, is cleared to contact Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government without involvement by the State Department. It is unknown who gave him permission to make the contact. By the next day, at the direction of Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, Christie has been fired from the presidential transition team. He will openly speculate that his objection to Flynn's participation in the transition was a primary cause of his dismissal. Vice President-elect Mike Pence immediately replaces Christie as the head of the transition team, even as Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn toss in the trash all the binders profiling potential administration nominees that Christie had been compiling. Pence will later say that he had no knowledge of what Flynn was planning to do, and ultimately did, with respect to covertly negotiating U.S. foreign policy with the Russians. This is how Politico will summarize Pence and his team's defense to allegations that, as head of Trump's transition team, he must have known something about that team's clandestine activities. Donald Trump's number two knew nothing at all. Their man was out of the loop, blissfully ignorant of contacts between the Trump campaign and various foreign actors, from the Russian ambassador to WikiLeaks. Shortly after he helps engineer Christie's ouster from and Flynn's emergence onto the presidential transition team, Kushner calls Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Kushner will not disclose the call on his SF-86 federal security clearance form, and when challenged, he will say that he does not remember speaking to Kislyak in November. Nevertheless, Kislyak appears at the back door of Trump Tower on December 1st or 2nd to discuss with Kushner and Flynn crafting a secure back channel between the White House and the Kremlin that is untraceable by the U.S. intelligence community. The purpose of the line, its proponents will contend when their actions are discovered many months later, is to allow Flynn to speak directly to the Russian military about America's Syria policy as well as other security issues. As Kerry Cordero, a 10-year Department of Justice national security expert, will write for Politico of the Kushner-Flynn-Kremlin pipeline, the issue is not so much that the White House wanted to establish a back channel with a foreign government on a particular matter. The issue is with whom they wanted to establish the channel, Russia, and how they reportedly wanted the channel to operate, using Russian facilities and secure communications. Did Kushner and Flynn realize that using Russian communications channels would either evade or appear to evade the U.S. intelligence community's own foreign intelligence surveillance activities? It's hard to believe they didn't. Another question is whether it was Kushner, Flynn, another party, or a number of parties, including Kushner and Flynn, who were concerned about domestic surveillance of their communications. 90 days after the Kushner-Flynn-Kislyak meeting in Trump Tower, a meeting whose other attendees, if any, are unknown, Donald Trump will accuse the Obama administration of using U.S. intelligence services to conduct surveillance of meetings held at Trump Tower during the presidential campaign, writing on Twitter, "How low has President Obama gone to tap my phones during the very sacred election process? This is Nixon Watergate. Bad or sick guy." If the surveillance Trump accused President Obama of in March 2017 had been in place in December 2016, it might have picked up Kushner and Kislyak discussing having the Trump administration use a sensitive, compartmented information facility, SCIF, controlled by the Russians to contact Russian generals securely. By negotiating U.S. policy with the Russians pre-inauguration using a SCIF, Kushner and Flynn would be violating the federal Logan Act, which prohibits unauthorized persons from negotiating U.S. foreign policy with agents of foreign governments. Kushner and Flynn won't join the government for 7 more weeks after their meeting with Kislyak. Because Kushner and Flynn have snuck Kislyak in the back door of Trump Tower, the media doesn't discover what they've been doing until well after Trump takes office. On December 5th, K.T. McFarland visits Trump Tower with her mentor, Bud McFarland, to see Flynn, with whom she will develop a close working relationship during the transition, particularly on the subject of negotiations with the Russians. McFarland had been selected on November 25th to act as Trump's deputy national security advisor under Flynn. One of the main proponents of her getting the job was Paul Erickson, a boyfriend of now-accused Russian spy Maria Butina. Another was McFarland, a VIP invitee of the pro-Kremlin Center for the National Interest when Trump delivered his Mayflower speech in D.C. in April 2016. See Chapter 6. A year later, in December 2017, McFarland will be accused of lying to Congress about her knowledge of Flynn's secret negotiations with Kislyak during the transition. After Flynn's firing in February 2017 and Trump's subsequent nomination of McFarland to be ambassador to Singapore, one of the Rosneft deal nations whose ambassador was present at the Mayflower, Congress asks McFarland in a written interrogatory whether she ever spoke to Flynn about his 2016 contacts with Kislyak. McFarland will answer in the negative. Her leaked emails later reveal, however, that not only did she know about the late December 2016 Flynn-Kislyak contacts in advance, but she advised Flynn as they were happening, and indeed did so from Mar-a-Lago, where Trump and many of his top aides were huddled at the time. McFarland's emails will reveal, too, that the discussion of Flynn's negotiations with the Russians at Mar-a-Lago involved many of Trump's top aides, including Trump's future chief of staff Reince Priebus, his future press secretary Sean Spicer, and the CEO of his 2016 campaign, Steve Bannon. Moreover, while the emails will not resolve whether Trump knew of the Flynn-Russia sanctions discussions, it is uncertain how involved Mr. Trump was, the New York Times will note. Reporters will observe that Trump was scheduled to meet with his national security team on the very day members of that team were being kept in the loop about Flynn's calls with Kislyak. Trump was also scheduled that day to have a phone call with nearly all the aides who had received McFarland's emails about Flynn and Kislyak. Flynn, McFarland, Priebus, and Bannon were all slated to take part in the call, which was due to happen shortly after McFarland sent an email to that group, plus Spicer, about Flynn's ongoing talks with the Russians. Another December 2016 K.T. McFarland email, uncovered in 2017, notes that if there is a tit-for-tat escalation on sanctions, Trump will have difficulty improving relations with Russia, which has just thrown USA election to him. Sergei Kislyak is not the only Russian trying to contact Trump and his team during the transition period. On November 28th, Emin Agalarov's publicist Rob Goldstone once again writes Rona Graf, the key conduit to Trump, according to Politico. What Goldstone sends to Graf in late November is a message from Aras Agalarov urging Trump to eliminate the Magnitsky sanctions on Russia. In making the request, Agalarov initiates at least the second follow-up on the June 2016 meeting at Trump Tower he had arranged, the first being Goldstone's late June email to Trump aide Don Scavino about a new Russia-oriented social media push for the Trump campaign. Members of Trump's campaign have long insisted, including under oath, that the June 2016 meeting was never followed up on in any fashion. Indeed, on July 8, 2017, a statement issued by Donald Trump Jr. about the June 2016 meeting, which was later found to have been dictated by Trump himself, will say that the Magnitsky Act was not a campaign issue at the time in June 2016, and there was no follow-up. That Trump dictated these words will not be discovered until June 2018, after many months of the Trump administration's denying that Trump had anything to do with the statement, and a shorter period of time in which the administration said Trump may have weighed in, like any father would do, but did not ultimately write the statement himself. The Magnitsky sanctions on which Agalarov lobbied Trump during the transition were leveled in mid-December 2012 against 44 suspected human rights abusers, many of whom are Russian government officials and businessmen, to punish the apparent state-sanctioned murder of a lawyer who accused the Putin government of corruption. Agalarov alleges, in his letter to Trump in November 2016, a series of facts identical to those raised by Kremlin agent Natalia Veselnitskaya at the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting, specifically allegations of a fraudulent tax scheme involving major Clinton donors. Agalarov's letter then references Veselnitskaya by name, as well as her arguments for ending the sanctions. Trump Jr., testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee on September 7, 2017, will agree that what Goldstone sent Trump's secretary on Agalarov's behalf was, generally speaking, the same as what was presented to him by Veselnitskaya in June 2016. Goldstone further offers to have a lawyer working to overturn the Magnitsky sanctions meet with Trump's transition team. After his early December meeting with Kushner and Flynn, Kislyak subsequently arranges for Kushner to meet on either December 13th or 14th with Sergei Gorkov, a former FSB agent and the head of Russian bank VEB, which is on the U.S. sanctions list. According to Foreign Policy, Gorkov runs a major state entity that is nearly a century old and effectively serves as a slush fund for the Kremlin's pet projects. Any decision to send Gorkov to serve as an intermediary with the Trump transition team would have been considered deliberately at the highest levels in the Kremlin. After the meeting, Gorkov and VEB issue a statement maintaining, as summarized by the Washington Post, that the session was held as part of a new business strategy and was conducted with Kushner in his role as the head of his family real estate business. Meanwhile, Kushner takes the position that the meeting was unrelated to business and was instead diplomatic in nature. The New York Times notes that as Trump's son-in-law and Gorkov meet, Kushner's company is in the midst of seeking financing for its troubled $1.8 billion purchase of an office building on Fifth Avenue in New York. Gorkov leaves New York and, according to flight records, goes directly to Japan, where Vladimir Putin is making a visit on December 15th and 16th. Having joined the transition team due to Kushner's intervention and having met with Kislyak alongside Kushner, in late December, Michael Flynn makes at least 5 calls to Kislyak to discuss both a pending UN resolution condemning Israeli settlements and the question of whether the United States will maintain its sanctions on Russia. Kushner is allegedly the very senior member of the Trump transition team who gives Flynn the order on December 22nd to make the calls to Kislyak. As the Washington Post will report, however, the talks were part of a series of contacts between Flynn and Kislyak that began before the November 8th election and continued during the transition. In a recent interview, Kislyak confirmed that he had communicated with Flynn by text message, by phone, and in person, but declined to say whether they had discussed sanctions. On December 12, 2016, former Trump National Security Advisor Carter Page makes his second trip of the year to Moscow. While there, he is asked by a Russian journalist during a public Q&A whether he has or plans to have any influence on Trump's transition team or administration, and whether he has any back channels to connect Moscow and Team Trump. Page does not answer any of the questions asked. Instead, he says, "The biggest influence is the process of helping to advance the objectives of the president-elect. One of the biggest areas of impact is in terms of various research projects, which I've been involved in with some of the most prominent leaders in the United States and in Russia. So it's absolutely accurate that I was limited in terms